Hi, good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are in the world, and welcome to Skid Row Chatter. My guest today is my good friend, confidant, and quite literally old partner in crime, Joe Clifford. But I see, Joe, your phone's being a little bit funky. Can say hello, make sure we got you live.
I'm here. Can you not hear me?
You're here? I'm working the dials here. I'm working my magic. You're just sitting there in your underwear with your feet on the desk. You know, it's a little more complicated than it seems to the guests and to the listening audience.
Was that your band that you played as the intro?
Was that what?
Was that Short Dogs?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Well, you know, you have to have permission to use the music. So Mick Jagger wouldn't return any of my emails, so I decided to just go ahead and use my
own. That was it. When I used to edit the literary magazine in Connecticut, I used to always put my stories in, my paintings on the cover. So yeah, I mean, I understand. You know, it's a Tom Pitt show.
Well, it was either that or using one of the. You know, when you search for images and you try to limit yourself to images that have that are up for use, of public domain.
Or as we call it, the Gutter Book Special. Yeah, I know.
Yeah, it narrows the search considerably.
I'm just saying, I played in a band. I have, you know, albums, you know, it'd be nice to ask the guest to use their music, but that's cool if you want to just promote yourself. No, what's up, man? We haven't talked in like an hour.
Intro. Hey, actually, Pam picked the intro. It's the same one we use every time. So you just deal with it. I don't really bring it up. I don't throw it in every conversation.
That's how I found you. I don't know if anybody knows the story of, I don't know if anybody cares about the story, but after we disappeared from the face of the earth, I couldn't find you. The only tie I had to you, I assumed you were dead, but the only tie I had to you was the fact that I knew you played in Short Dogs Grow. And so I would go on like, this is how hard I tried to find you. I'd go on chat rooms where they like talked about you because you're a pretty big band, pretty big deal in music. And that's how I found you is through Short Dogs. It was through a porn star who knew your bass player who knew you. That's how I got
that's a whole nother story. I'll have to pass
God
that on to
Carmella. Busy Borden. Thank you.
She didn't get something passed on to herself by knowing him. Hey, I will say this. You know, the picture we've been floating about in promotion for the show, which is you and me looking considerably younger and skinnier. And people know about our wild, crazy past, but that picture was from that night when you showed up in 2006 and we went out for burritos on Mission Street there.
It wasn't 2006. Oh, yeah, I guess it was 2006. It was right after Darcy broke up with me and I came out to see Carrie, and she took the picture. And
that was after the flood, after the fire, after the madness, so to speak.
Yeah, that was the first time I've seen you since the Hepatitis Heights days.
You showed up the house with a stack full of literary periodicals and mentioned that you had some stories in them, and I stuck them on my shelf. You know, they might still be on my shelf. We'll have to double check.
Yeah. The Helix. Yeah,
it's very difficult being a writer and reaching outside the writing community and doing the, hey, read my stuff. And, you know, people aren't prone to just, hey, you know what? I'm just going to sit down, have a cup of coffee right now and burn through this. It's a weird sort of thing. An engaging thing to ask someone to do if they're not an avid reader already. You know what I mean?
Well, I mean, that was my first, you know, foray into writing. So I didn't realize just how many people wrote. Like, I mean, I'd just gone back to school and all that. And I was, you know, getting my degree. I didn't realize like literally every other person you see on the street is a writer. At the time it was like, oh, wow, I'm writing. This is really cool. And maybe somebody would care about this. But then you realize like, you know, everybody in your Uncle Bob is a writer. So,
on the bright side, spinning it positive, the writing community is so large. A good portion of that is also your readership. So, I mean, it kind of lends to itself and it supports itself to a degree. You know what I mean?
Yeah, the only people that go to poetry readings are other poets, like Bukowski says.
Yeah, sad but true. Well, it's sad, but just sad.
It's just sad.
So did you mention you write? You write now, Joe? Is that true?
Yeah, that's what I do. I write.
So you're here flogging books.
Yeah, I write.
You're here flogging your latest. December Boys. Let's start off by chatting about that a little. What's the story there? When's it coming out? Who's got it? Where can they find it? All that stuff.
Well, you can find it at all the usual places. You know, what's that echo?
You hear me echoing? Because I have your volume.
I hear my voice. I hear my voice echoing. It's freaking me out, man.
I can bring it down some, but I need to be able to hear you.
December Boys, you can find, you know, anywhere because it's a regular press and it's not like an indie press now to bring the books around like consignments. They're just a regular book. They, you know, Ocean View has its own distributor and all that stuff. So it's, you go to a bookstore if you want it, they'll give it to you. Amazon, you know, Barnes & Noble. We just saw it was on Walmart, which is, my wife was very excited it was in Walmart. My wife, God bless her, but she, you know, she has this weird infatuation with Walmart. She thinks it's, because it's such a foreign concept to somebody who's grown up in the Bay Area. Not that we don't have Walmarts here, but just, it's such a heartland, you know, mainstream sort of weird peripheral existence for the people of Walmart. So she was very excited.
To you, there's the Walmart down by the Oakland Airport and the one in Richmond, and they are both hotspots for shootings and all sorts of random violence. So, yeah, that's East Bay Walmart's a whole other thing. But I will say this about the gauntlet of Walmart as far as distribution of books. I see that as a big thing because they have such a limited selection. You know, they got, you know, right wing radio host Michael Savage's latest and some, you know, some crazy religious stuff. And then your Stephen King's. And I saw Owen Lachinen's book in there and I was so impressed. And I told him, I was like, man, you're in Walmart. That's incredible.
Owen, yeah, I'm not even gonna try to say his last name, but he's a big deal, man. Everybody loves Owen. He's such a nice guy too. I met him at the Noir at the bar when he came out in San Francisco. Just a great writer and just a really nice guy.
Canadian thing.
So, fucking Canadians. Yeah. So.
Pam may have told you otherwise, but we are
trains all the time. Stop doing it. What do you want to talk about? My book. It's funny because.
Well, yeah, I do want to talk about the book. I want to start off
working on another book. I'm working on the sequel to. December Boys. So it's strange. It really dawned on me the other day, like, holy shit, I have a book coming out in a couple of weeks. Cause I've been, you know, one of the best bits of advice I got, there's lots of good advice you get, but one of the best bits of advice I got was to keep working on something because, you know, as you're waiting for agents to write you back or editors to write you back or publishers to write you back or just all these things to happen, you got to keep busy. You know, it's the watch pot thing. And I finally started doing that. So since getting December Boys, you know, I finished December Boys last year, I've written two books. Pretty much just writing every day nonstop, you know, not nonstop, you know, I mean, writing the way we write, which is kind of a lazy style of writing, but writing consistently. So it's weird to go back and realize that, yeah, there's a, you know, cause I'm kind of down the road a little bit. What do you want to know about the book? It's about Jay Porter. He's,
well, I mean,
you know,
I've already read the third one. And yeah. So my short-term memory, which is, probably has to do with a lot of the drug damage, has already wiped clean most of December Boys because my brain is already tied up with Jay in the third one. And I'm not going to, you know, focus on that because it's a year away from being out. But loosely tell us what, you know, it's after Lamentation, does spring happen or is it just eternal fucking winter in that town?
Yeah, it's eternal winter. Every book is going to take place in the winter. I toyed with the idea of you know, because Jay Porter is actually based on my my half brother Jay Streeter, who also works in estate clearing. He's just talked to him today. Poor guy, man, he really is just like Jay Porter. But he lives in Florida now. He lived in New Hampshire and he moved to Florida. And I toyed with this idea of transplanting. You know, the stories are moving him around. You know, like Rob Hart is doing with his Ash McKenna books, and he's moving them around. But it seems to me that Lamentation really is a character in the books. You know that. That cold, infertile, you know, hostile, perpetual winter, the frozen tundra of Lamentation.
It seems like a black cloud over every story, and it's you're right, it is, it's its own character, and it definitely plays a part. And I've often commented that, you know, I got to put on a jacket just to read a damn thing, but it's effective, you know, because Jay's a conflicted, you know, I was just gonna say your poor buddy Jay, is he as miserable as Jay too? Because it's he's a bit chilled himself. He's a cold guy.
Jay's personality is probably more based on me. Sadly, you know what I did is I take the fights I have with Justine, right? You know, my wife, And I take the fights we have verbatim. You know, of course, you, when you're fighting, you know, you're right, right? I mean, that's why you're fighting. And, you know, so the arguments we have, I take verbatim and I put them in my books. And, you know, every single time somebody reads it, they're like, God, that guy's a jerk. She's, how did she, why did she put up with him? I'm like, fuck, man, I thought I was right. Yeah, I mean, Jay's, you know, Jay's a, you know, he's got a lot of East Coast in him. There's an East Coast thing that happens. It's different than out here. You know, the land out there is just, everything's so claustrophobic. You know, everything, mountain peaks rise higher and everything's just, there's knots and gnarls and knolls. And out here, you got wide open spaces. You know, you can see from everything there is, you know, it's really right on top of you. And it creates a, you know, a claustrophobic feeling. And of course, you know, the winters there are brutal. And I lived in Connecticut, which wasn't nearly as bad as that. But that's why I put this up by the Canadian border, because there seems something I don't know if you know about the Iceman theory, and I don't even know if this is a true theory. This was told to me by Brian Fast, who, any of you who's read Junkie Love will, and knows Brian Fast, knows he was a fucking liar. But he had told me that the Iceman theory is based on this idea that the reason white people are so mean, you know, is because they have no pigmentation, right? But because they lived away from the sun, and where they lived was cold, and everything was, you know, to get your food, you had to dig in the ground and just bred this meanness. You know, I doubt it's true because, like I said, he's a liar, but I like that idea.
I'd like to interrupt here and dispel that theory and just say Canadians.
Yeah. Canadians, you are lovely people. Yeah, Hillary Davidson, Owen, whose last name I can't even begin to pronounce. Well, then you got Benoit, though, because he's a little nasty, right? He's got a little surliness to him.
Quite French-Canadian. You
didn't get to pass. He's a French-Canadian. I'm reading the thread of his Facebook rant that he put on your page there.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. Who knows? But that's what I wanted to do with Lamentations. I wanted to make it, you know, where everything's kind of, you know, you're fighting for scraps. You know, there's a nastiness that happens, but there's also, you know, there's a lot of, you know, beauty and love in those things too. If you don't have some sort of hope, I mean, everything with Jay is that, you know, he's right on the cusp of almost getting it. I don't know. You've probably known people like this who are people you almost like, or you kind of think could be, you know, they just are missing that one little thing. And that's Jay. And in the town he lives, he's superior probably intellectually to everybody, because they're just like even dumber than that. So it's just weird. It creates this weird power structure, you know, having the tools, but just not enough to be happy. It's almost, you know, you'd almost be better off being one of the Turleys, you know, who plays the sheriff in the book, than you would somebody like Jay.
The intellectual prowess of a narrator when it's first person, like Jay, all three are in first person from his perspective. And it seems like it's a tough thing to deal with, because, you know, as the narrator, you have to articulate the story. You have to describe things to convey what's in your brain to the reader. So thus, your character has to have a certain amount of intellect, or you end up writing a really sort of monosyllabic kind of trotting
Tom,
book.
I have
so,
to interrupt you here for a moment. We have a comment from Hector Jr. there, who has taken over as the editor for the Flash Fiction Offensive. And Hector would like us to know that we sound like we're tripping over each other. And he tells you to, and I quote, just a piece of humble advice, pause a little more to let Joe answer. So just
well,
to
you
let you know, your co-editor is already editing.
Well, you know, clearly he hasn't listened to too many of these shows, because it is usually just chaos. And I kind of feel
I
like
think
we're doing
I think I'm talking fine, but what I, you know, you talk about, I really do have fucking brain damage from all the drugs. I think I'm talking fine. Like, to me, I hear the words in my head and they come out of my mouth and they sound fine to me, but I'll listen back to this shit later on and I fucking sound like I'm on speed. I mean, my speech patterns, they're all fucking, it's all fucked up. That's what happens when you smoke meth off aluminum foil and inject that shit. I mean, it really does.
To slow down. Take a breath, slow down.
I am slowing down. And that's the thing. I'm slowing down. I'm even worse than this usual. What do you have that you're saying?
Hector, calm down. Now you're saying it. But listen, here's my piece of
advice. Hector now says, oh my God, now I feel like an asshole. Fuck both of you all. Hector just told us to go fuck ourselves. Yeah.
I know. I got it up here. He's flashing me too. But I'm just saying, here's my piece of advice. After doing 10 or 12 of these shows, I will say to you, don't ever listen to them back.
Yeah.
You.
No, I never do.
Oh, yeah. You just said you did. Joe, you read your own reviews.
I do read my interviews. I know I watched what I watched, because I'm going back to Connecticut, and I'm doing that going back on Fox TV back there, and I watched that interview on TV, and fuck, man, I shouldn't have done that. I look so angry and miserable, and I'm not really that angry and miserable.
That's
But just the look on my face, it looks like, geez, Christ. All right, well.
Let's get away from your anxiety for a second and get back to the books. It's coming out June 2nd, and it's coming out
Segue. Yeah, here's a segue, though, and this is actually going to be germane to our conversation. What happens to Jay in December, boys, is he's – I don't want to give away Lamentation for those who haven't read it, but it's really a sister novel. It's kind of the flip side of that book. And from the events of that first book, Jay is dealing with panic attacks, anxiety disorder, which is, ripped straight from the real life of the author. And when you have anxiety, it's a strange way to live. I mean, you have medication that can quell, the worst of it. But the truth is that you just kind of live with it, so you're always on this heightened, state of awareness. Everything's kind of moving, nothing's really, it's hard to just slow down by saying slow down, just calm down, just relax. It's not something you can really do on command, because I also drink a lot of espresso, man. I drink a lot of espresso. I mean, I probably drink like 6, 7, 8, 9 a day.
Yeah.
But yeah, the book comes out this June 7th. It's actually out now because Amazon starts shipping it early. So if you want it, you can get it early. And if you've and I'll tell our listeners here, I don't know how many have tuned in, but I have it on good authority that those of you who have waited might want to wait for the electronic version the first week, because it may be at a significantly lower price. And we'll just throw that out there.
There's your Skid Row Chatter insider bargain of the week, of the month.
Yeah.
let's talk a minute for about Ocean View Press. Now they're sure. They're not a big house. They're not a small press. They've got full distribution. What's the story with them?
They are called a midsize, and they are wonderful. They have every year for the last, I don't know how many years, but they always have one of their books is up for the best novel at the Anthony's. They're up there with the big boys. They don't have the nice thing about being at a press that size is, I was talking to Seth Harwood and we were talking about what happens if one of the big five takes you and they don't get fully behind you, and are you better off languishing there or being kind of a big fish in a smaller pond? They aren't an indie. So, you get away from that, but, it's nice having a slightly, more hands-on experience in every book that comes out. I mean, I feel important. I get a lot of attention, and for somebody like me, I need a lot of attention. And it's worked out really well. And they like the Jay Porter series, and they seem like they'll keep buying it. As long as people keep buying the book, they'll keep buying it from me.
Beyond the third book, you feel like there may be a I know where it goes. I know it's kind of open ended, but you foresee it could even go further. So Jay may end up on the beaches of Miami.
Jim Hall did an interview with Pam. Jim Hall, I studied with Jim at Florida International University, and he was talking about wrapping up his series. And he was like, when I set out to write the Thorn books, I didn't envision writing 17. Now, I can't imagine writing 17 Jay Porter books. But, after you write, this last one came together so quickly. You have the idea of who the character is, and it gels in your head. And you know how he thinks. You know how he feels. You can anticipate his moves. They feel more real. They feel more organic. Working on a standalone that I'm working on now, the Darkly book, it's harder because you have to tap into, another person, another motivation. Jay has become such a part of me that it's easy enough to, kind of put on that coat. That's a little foreshadowing for the third book, and figure out where he's going to go. One person is going to get. Yeah.
Well, speaking of staying away from falling into the Lee Child syndrome, we'll call it, where the author thinks he's doing something fresh, but it is it's not always. In case he's listening, I won't slam him too hard.
We should all be as stale as Lee Child.
But I will say that you kept it fresh because I've actually read your other standalones that are still waiting in the wings, and partially it's my own preference towards third person stuff, and partially it's because and I know this from knowing you that Jay's a tough guy to spend a lot of time with. After a while, you're like, man, just stop it. He's he's Jay Porter. Your audience knows him. But tell us a little bit about the couple of books that you've got prepped, ready to go, ready for the other shoe to drop.
I will, but I will address that point first.
You may not.
Yeah, wow, that's loud. I was writing the third book somewhere in the middle, and Justine, my wife, said, stop it, you're acting like Jay Porter. And I'm not a beer drinker. I don't drink a lot of beer. I don't drink a lot, period. But when I write the Jay Porter books, I drink more beer. I wrote a post about this, and I'm hoping to do a panel on this at BoucherCon, where because Jay has the anxiety, I literally developed, and that's twice I've used literally, I'm sorry, but I literally developed left eye tic while I was writing the book because he gets so worked up and anxious, and I write the book and I get into that character and I get so worked up and anxious. It's a strange guy to spend time with, and he's not, he's of course you have feelings of fondness for your characters, but every book has to be what the book wants it to be. You have your idea of what you want it to be, and then this is what the book wants it to be. And when I started writing this, I envisioned Jay probably a little different, and as I began writing and seeing what was happening in his life and where he was going, there were some turns. Now, it's funny because I get different reactions to Jay. There's people like you who think he's a jerk, and I certainly – there's a large number of them. Book List just had a nice review, but they basically called him a jerk. But then there's other people who, still feel like he's a good guy and he's trying to do the right thing, and they understand him a little more, and they view him a little more sympathetically, which I guess is good, because you want everybody to get what they can get out of it. I mean, you're probably coming at it because, of the personal attachment to me and that ice cream cone that you've never really – forgive me for. So you're probably reading between the lines.
I don't think I need to forgive you for that because you were in the wrong.
Yeah.
You've never really given me a proper apology
we
now.
Supposed
in the
to
public
go to school and you were
to
running
that.
Off to Raph's house. All right. Yeah, that's all right, man. It's all a long time ago. It's 16.
See, you thought I was going to pull you into the dark days and have you relive our wild years in the 90s when we met, but no, we kept it above board. We kept it class. We kept it literary.
I think so. I think.
Yeah.
So. You want to talk about books we've read?
Let me throw this at you before we take the break. What are you reading right now?
Oh no. Well, wait on. Now because of the severe mild brain damage, I realized you asked me a question 5 minutes ago that I'm just gonna get around to answering. You want to know the two books that I'm working on. So one is the Jay Porter book, right? Jay Porter 3, but the other one's called Through a Glass Darkly, which I might change the title to something a little less biblical. And but it's about a girl who escapes an abduction. So that's what I'm working on now. And okay, hold on a second. Now, Hector really is into this. Do we have anybody else listening besides Hector? He's like the new Panzer.
While you read that, I got to take care of some business here. Hang on. Because this is something that we have to do at the bottom of every hour. And I gotta say that Skid Row Chatter is a trademark copyrighted podcast solely owned by Authors on the Air Global Network, LLC. And now back to it. Hey, by the way, if you have a question or beef with Joe Clifford, you can call in. I don't have the number in front of me because I'm that much of a professional. But it's listed there on the Facebook page and also on the link that you're listening to now. And you can call in and we'll see if we can get you up on the air with Mr. Clifford. Now go ahead.
Okay. Well, Hector had we have a question from the 409. I don't even know what area code that is. He wants to know about mapping out a story that takes place over several books and how do I keep track, notebooks or dry erase boards or physical maps. That's way too much fucking work. I am at heart a lazy person. I mean, I work hard at writing, but I am not like we were talking about. I had lunch today with Michael Thompson and we were talking about historical romance. And can you imagine
Speaking
anything
of beer,
more
guy.
Arduous than Can you imagine anything worse than having to research a historical novel? Like if you get like the teletype wrong, and they're like, oh, that came out in, whatever year. I can't imagine how bad that would be. The people who have to write historical romance. I want to work hard, but I want to work hard on different areas. I'm certainly not going to do that kind of research. So, the nice thing about the more you do this, the more it becomes second nature. I mean, the first book I wrote took me 10 years. And the last one I wrote, pretty much a draft in a month. little more than a month to get something workable. You know, you begin to see these things a little more. The parts begin to gel a little quicker. You know, I will write things down on paper, if, you know, and do map out that way if it happens, or I feel like I'm getting lost. But at this point, I have a pretty good idea of where each book is going in terms of the series. You know, I know a broad picture that the book can't end with Jay in a too happy, stable place. I mean, I can't have him married with kids living in suburbia and no problems, because that's not a book. That was the hardest part about writing the sequel, because Lamentation, you know, after we came out with that, my agent wanted to know if I wanted to do a sequel, you know, and she could pitch it to Ocean View. And the hardest thing was going to be, I was going to have to disrupt a little bit of tranquility I'd give them. I ended the book where I thought, not a happy ending, but a place where there was some hope. And the first thing I had to do was go in there and rip up his life, because that's what propels fiction, right? You know, bad things and things going wrong and wanting this and getting that and trying to make sense of the madness. Otherwise, you know, you have something else. I don't know what you have, but it's not what I write.
Answer to Hector's question is simply you have a fictional town, a fictional place, so you don't have to deal with things that bog your story down, like facts and reality.
I come from a literary fiction background. I don't like admitting that, but we're all friends here. I come from a literary fiction background, so I still have that pretty much. You know, if I didn't go to FIU, I was going to Amherst. And Amherst, I would have written a totally different book, Florida International. You know, MFAs have their rap, but like, I could not write a book without an MFA. Just the way my brain works, I couldn't figure out how to do A to B. And all. My brain doesn't work that way.
FIU would screw me up.
Well, you just have this thing where you learned it through osmosis. I just could not do it. You know, and I had Lynn Barrett and Les Staniford and James Hall and John Dufresne and Dan Wakefield and all these people who just were able to get this through to me, and it was great. And I owe my career to FIU. But, you know, I might owe my career to Amherst if I didn't go to FIU, and that's where I was headed when I got the call that I'd been accepted, and frankly, FIU was giving me a lot more money. So, you know, I still have that literary, you know, that's where I came from. So I combine, you know, it's a literary crime sort of thing, but I'm interested in character still, more so than maybe the average crime writer, which can be dangerous, you know, if you get too pretentious.
You know where I learned to spin a good tale and the true art of fiction? Was Skipper Nick.
Skipper Nick! Hey, I owe him $10,000. boy, what a fucking asshole, huh?
Boy, well, you know, and I know he's out there on Facebook somewhere, and he very well may be listening, but yeah, fuck him. What an animal.
If he is listening, he's a fucking asshole. He's a fucking liar. I mean, he would chip that plaster, try to tell you it was speed. He'd chip plaster right off the wall and be like, here, I got speed. Like, I just saw you fucking chip the thing off the wall.
No, it's good stuff.
Lying sack of shit. What? Yeah, I know.
He was one of those people that had a need to lie, not only when there was no reason, but just beyond. I was reminded the other day of one of the first stories I wrote, and you probably remember it. And it was about that first night I spent in Hepatitis Heights, and I went home. Paul took and let me sleep on his filthy floor there on like my own little ragged suitcase I was lugging around, and I woke up with Skipper Nick digging through my hair. And I'm like, what are you doing? Get off of me. And if he had no reason to be literally with massaging my scalp. He goes, there's mice in your hair. And he tried to convince me that there was mice running through my hair. And that's why he needed to be going through all my personal person, not only my pockets, but my scalp. I mean, I'm not quite sure what he was looking for up there. But the guy's
in Nick's defense, there's a chance there might have been mice in your hair. Because, I mean, that place is fucking crawling with mice.
I do love the mice.
Yeah. Yeah, defined. Good time.
For the members of the audience who may not already have been bored by this story, Joe and I used to live in this terrible, I guess it was a squat. I mean, no one paid rent. In a terrible house.
That's
up on
not true. I fucking paid rent for the first four fucking months I paid there. I gave fucking Nick $1,000 for four fucking months. He didn't give a penny to the landlord. Just kept it. Just didn't.
Okay,
you know, the landlord came around. I was like, you guys going to pay rent? I'm like, I've been paying rent. Yeah, so on top of being a liar, he's a thief too.
Yeah. He also he stole my laptop that had my work of genius, my book, my gem, my opus that I was creating back in the 90s, and he pulled it apart one night and denied ever seeing my laptop, and he the only reason he didn't even take it to sell, he just took it to take apart in the middle of the night. and toy with its.
I kind of miss him though. Don't you miss him a little bit?
No.
You know, I was reading Catcher in the Rye. I was reading Catcher in the Rye to Holden. And my son Holden, and you get to that part, and he's like, "Don't ever tell a story about him, because even if you fucking hate him, you start missing him." I mean, I kind of miss him a little bit. I mean, I wouldn't mind seeing him to say hi. I mean, from a distance.
I'm gonna remind you of the silver dollar pancake size hole he dug in his forehead at least once a month when he walked in, and there was blood dripping down his nose, and it was glistening like the largest third eye of raw meat you could imagine. No, I don't miss him. I get chills when I think about that house. Really nailed that house with where the DA coming to the door and all the sort of madness and chaos. That's what that place was like on a daily basis.
Yeah, I mean, I can't stay up after 10 o'clock now. I don't know how we live like that. I really don't. It was just absolutely insane. You know, his girlfriend taking all my DAT tapes, every recording I ever did, she just took them out and like lit them on fire one night. It was so fucking strange. Like, it was so surreal. It was an episode of a Twin Peaks or something. I don't know if that place was even, if you hadn't been there, I wouldn't even know if it existed. I mean, that's how strange and surreal and just odd. You know, you have that weird, you haven't slept in days. So everything's kind of, the walls are melting anyway. And everyone looks funny and nobody's, you know, he eats and everybody, you know, get that meth mouth and they're talking and they're not looking at you. It's just a strange, like, I don't even know if half the stories I tell actually happened.
Well, one distinct memory I have is you and me, and this happened on a daily basis. We'd be locked in the bathroom trying to shoot up in our toes or our armpits, because that's all that was left. And people would come and bang. And, you know, the only reason we were in the bathroom is to keep our drugs. It's not like we needed privacy, because everyone was shooting up in the whole place. We needed to keep our, you know, no, we don't have any drugs. And someone would come and bound on the door. What are you guys doing? What do you got in there? And, you know, what do you want? Go away. And they'd say, you know, I need to take a shower. I need to take a bath. And I remember you and me both, like, hunched over the bathtub, blood dripping down our limbs, and peeking over in the bathtub. And it was, as usual, filled with broken glass. I mean, nobody bathed that fucking shithole. You know, it was just the most unhealthy. It was absolutely 100% the end of the road. I mean, and I had years as a functioning junkie and various levels of drug addiction, but that was it. That was the bottom. And of course, that's where I met you.
Yeah. And there it is. And
yeah.
I want to talk about something else? I'm kind of done. I don't get tired about talking about drugs. I think I'm finally fed up. Yeah, I'm fed up now. I'm done with drugs. They're no good. Don't do them. They have, you know.
What our actually, audience I mean, wants to know is hope. When we're going to be fed up with drug stories.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. Maybe for the next 20 minutes, I'll try not to talk. It's hard not to talk about drugs. You know, that's. I don't really do much now. You know, like most of my social life, my stories all stem from that crazy 10-year period. I mean, everything I write about is. Even though I write about it from the other side, you know, Lamentation, Jay's, you know, the straight man, but it's still, he's looking outside into that, you know, crazy world. And, you know, there's something weird and wonderful and beautiful. And I don't know how to explain it without, if I hadn't, you know, had lived through it or how you'd explain it to somebody who hasn't lived through it. But that day-to-day existence where you don't know if you're going to, you know, you're going to die or
well, there's a singularity to your existence. There's such a focus. It's such a simple existence because there's really only one thing you're trying to accomplish day in and day out. And you don't have the trappings of regular life, like, you know, bills, responsibilities, relationships, because it's all about, and everyone, you know, it's all about the one thing. And that there's, I wouldn't call it a beauty, but there is a uniqueness to that there's an animal sort of behavior that sort of comes out. You're just rolling by instinct, and how different people react in different ways. I mean, remember Paul would just lay on his bed and weep till someone brought him junk, but you and I were go-getters and we had to go out and make it happen on a daily basis. And it's very vivid.
Boy, that guy. Yeah, it was vivid. I mean, in a way, it was, you know, you have the euphoric recall. When you go through enough rehabs, you know, they drill this through your head that it wasn't as wonderful as you remember, but you sort of do remember, you know, the good times more than you do the bad times. The bad times are just in the abstract. I mean, I know they were pretty rotten times, but, you know, you don't feel the actual pain because it's, you know, you're so far removed. You know, you
well,
almost
I,
look back
I,
on it in a weird fondness.
Yeah, bathtub full of broken glass. Good times.
Yeah.
Good times.
Good times.
Good hey, listen, times. If any of our listeners do want to call in and try to get Joe to change the subject, our guest call-in number is 347.
You're the fucking host. Ask me a different question, man.
9609. Hey, I'm the host here. I'm talking. 347-633-9609. I feel like you're trying to talk over the number because you don't want anybody to call in and call you on your shit. That's what I feel like's going on.
I just don't want to talk to John Panzer because you know who that's calling. John Panzer calling in 3-2. not any call. Actually, any call in. We can talk about stuff.
He's off the radar. But one thing we kind of glossed over, and I'm not sure why you did. You know, when I was referring to your standalones, you know, you have two other completed. It shouldn't hurt because they're going to move. Maybe they're that's a whole nother conversation. But Occam's Razor, which I feel is, you know, I've read all your books, all of them, Occam's is I think maybe my favorite. I still like Skunk Train, which you sort of feel like was an experiment of sorts. Those aren't in the drawer. Those are just waiting to be born. They're seeds planted in the ground.
Yeah, I mean, what I get more from Occam's Razor, the response we get time and time again is that it doesn't suck them in, which I don't understand. I mean, because I think that book moves so fast, and obviously I wrote it, but after a while, you know, you begin to hear the same response, and you start to you start to believe it. I mean, right? I mean, how can you not?
It's a tight, proper mystery. But you know what is a little bit different about that book is it doesn't have the gloom and the darkness and some of the shady behavior that you've, like you were just saying. You know, a lot of your stories stem from those 10 chaotic years of the 90s. It doesn't have that attached to it, which I think, you know, from my perspective, is perfectly refreshing. It's well constructed. It moves well. The characters are good. It hits all the high points. But do you think that that's what it is? Is that the ingredient that you feel isn't making it sell?
You know, I don't know. I mean, I think probably the biggest reason it's not selling is the same reason books don't sell often, which is that, you know, people buying the books, the editors, they're a little gun shy, you know, it's a huge investment, and there's got to be something that pulls them forward, that makes them, you know, make that leap. And whatever that thing is, it's not in the book. I mean, it's structurally, in terms of the craft, I wrote it the way I write all my books, and you know, the other books sell, and I don't know why that one hasn't sold.
I'm a believer it just hasn't landed on the right desk, you know.
Yeah.
I will say this: it was a shock in getting books sent out by an agent, and you know, getting the feedback, and you know, thinking that you have hooked a deal because an editor somewhere likes it, wants to take it on, and oh, wait a second, there's another step. It's got to go before the marketing department, and they've got to decide before they take the book on that they love. We love it. We believe in it. It's going to be great. That there's a group, a table, a conference room with a long table full of bean counters that say, you know, how many can we sell of this, and who are we going to sell it to, and exactly what kind of demographic are we going for? And that kind of, you know, that no matter how much passion an editor has, if he's got to go through that kind of gauntlet, it kills a lot of great literature, and it doesn't. They don't get.
Well, I went through that firsthand with Junkie Love, and you know, you got to remember at that time I didn't have anything published, so you know, I had a different agent at the time, and she forwarded me a response from an editor that was basically, I've been waiting my whole life for a book like this. I read it in one sitting. This is amazing. This is why I got into the business. You couldn't have a more glowing endorsement from an editor. And this was an acquisitions editor. So, you know, I remember writing Big Tom being like, yeah, I mean, I sold the book. There's no way they're not going to buy it. Well, what happened is they kicked it up to the bean counters, and they were like, yeah, another junkie book? No. And that was it. And once that door closed, all the doors closed. I couldn't get that book published with a traditional publisher, you know, a bigger publisher. My agent dropped me. And it was a matter of, you know, just almost, it felt like overnight. There's a strange collective unconscious that kind of ripples through an industry where somebody in, like, you know, San Francisco is who isn't in communication with somebody in New York, and they both turn it down at the same time. I can't explain how that works, but that's what it felt like happened with that book. And it was,
well, you know, that happens in the movie business with even more intensity. You know, if someone wants no one wants something, and then if one person wants it, then suddenly there's this groundswell, and everybody wants it, and a bidding war happens. But as soon as somebody says no, it's like the screenplay has herpes, and nobody's going to kiss it, and it just and it dies on the vine overnight. It's and I think it's a little more intense in the movie business, partially because pool, the gossipy pool of people whispering in each other's ears is even smaller than in the book business.
Have you seen the movie The Big Picture with Kevin Bacon? Probably the best Kevin Bacon movie. It's just fantastic. That's what it's all about. Hey, don't knock Kevin Bacon. But that's what it's all about is he's trying to get his movie out there and, you know, this ripple effect. It's great. It's got David St. Hubbins from Spinal Taps, and it's a great movie. Spinal Taps is a song. Well, him and, yeah, Michael Tufnell and
I believe I have. I can't remember what it's called now, but I watched a documentary recently of it was on Netflix, and it may have been called The Writer's Room. I'm not even sure, but it was a documentary on
screenwriting.
What else? Sit
Around the Table and Shit? Oh, is that Sit Around the Table?
No.
John Favreau was usually a part of it. Oh.
They were all these poor bastards who had huge movies, some of them Oscar movies under their belt, and they couldn't sell their next movie. And some of the insane hoops they had to jump through to try to get their shit even looked at, and how much of their shit was taken on and never made. It was just one of the most depressing movies about
from The Big Picture, where Kevin Bacon goes to get a waiter's job because his movie's not working, and the guy hiring him is like, oh, you're a director? Give me your busboy's a director. You know, that kind of thing. So, yeah.
Yeah. Well, that being said, any movie interest in the Lamentation?
Yeah, and the same fucking thing that happened with Junkie Love. Like, we had people, like, the French wanted it, and then we had movie interest, and then it dies up and something else happens. If I could figure that out, man, it drives me nuts. I mean, I want to go to fucking France. I really want to go to France. And who doesn't want a movie deal? But it looked like we were getting a movie deal. My wife wants a movie deal because I told her if I get a movie deal, I'll get her Pomeranian. So basically, puppies are literally dying. Third time I've used literally, but they are literally dying because I can't get the fucking Pomeranian because I made a deal with the universe that they have to give me a movie deal before I buy a rescue dog.
You have a sit down thing with the universe, huh? You stomp your feet, get what you want, and then
Tom, I don't know if you know me, but that's pretty much how I've lived my entire life. I stomp my feet.
My name's Jordan.
Okay, hold it. All right, get out of here. All right, that was my son. Yeah, I pretty much stomp my feet until I get my way. That's what I've done my whole life.
Do you reward the universe if the universe treats you properly? What do you do for the universe?
I give.
Right.
Yes, he is. Yes, he is. Jackson and Holden. We're both in the Lamentation book, so this doesn't feel totally out of left field. They're both.
All I heard is what it sounded like.
Is Aiden and Jackson is Jackson.
All I heard was Holden say was, "Hello, my name is Holden, and I'm an alcoholic." Is that what he said?
Not yet. Give it. He's got another 12 years before he blames Dad for that. I mean, how am I going to explain that? I mean, I got a giant syringe on the cover of my book. You know, what am I going to do when he's 16? Like, don't. Yeah, worked out for Dad, but don't. You don't go down this path. Pretty terrifying stuff. You know, as a parent, as I'm sure you fret about as well. I mean,
As a godfather, I know my responsibility is way heavy. I sometimes have trouble sleeping at night, not knowing if things are okay across the bay.
The Ivory Tower, we're doing very well over here. Things are lovely over here. Lucky just joined me. My pal Cool just got a nice haircut.
Before we wrap things, and we might, since we have no call in, so either nobody's listening or they're all afraid to talk to you, and just go ahead and think the latter.
All right. I
want to
talk about the worst.
I want to plug my next show because it's going to be awesome. And you're the guy that when I told you he was going to be on, you're like, are you fucking kidding me? But next month on the 25th, we're having Max Allen Collins. And you like this guy. Why?
Because he's fucking awesome. And he's great.
That's
he's
not good enough.
Tradition.
You're right. You can do better than that.
He's great. I mean, he's in that Mammoth Book of Pulp with the Ordo story, the Donald Westlake story. He's fantastic. He's a great writer. Couldn't believe you got him.
He wrote Road to Perdition. Not only has he read Road to Perdition, he's written Dick Tracy comics. He's written he was the only guy that was allowed to finish Mickey Spillane's books, and he's written Batman, and he's written the Captain America comic book. So he's got
huge.
His finger in
I've
a lot
seen
of
at conferences. I've always been scared to talk to him. I can't even say hi to him.
Oh really?
Yeah, he goes to conferences.
I googled his picture and he looks a little bit like Elton John.
He looks like Elton John, yeah. Yeah.
A little bit.
He looks like Elton
little
John.
Bit.
Yeah. Not a lot.
All right, enough of me plugging my own show. What do you need to plug that's coming up here? What's next on the plate for you?
What's next? I'm going to Connecticut doing that book tour. I've got a bunch of – I'm doing the launches, which you're going to be a part of, which Ryan Leone is going to be a part of.
When's the Berkeley launch?
Reading it. Berkeley launch is the 17th of June. I'm doing In Conversation with David Corbett up at Book Passage. That's going to be the 10th of June. Where There Are Words will be the 9th of June. Then I'm doing I'm teaching up the Book Passage over the summer. I'm going to go back to Connecticut, do the Fox thing, read at my old college, you know, BoucherCon, you know.
Jeez.
Living the dream, man. Living the dream,
well,
Tom.
Yeah. It's somebody's dream.
I don't know why Hector's
calling. Depending on how you look at it.
Hector's clearly listening. Hector's listening. Why wasn't he calling?
Hector doesn't want to call in. He keeps on saying, don't say this is for me, but
I know.
he's the man behind the curtain. Hector, the way, is our new editor down at the Flash Fiction Offensive and Out of the Gutter Online, where Joe has just unceremoniously stepped down because the responsibility
is on
his shoulders. Pardon me?
Yeah, I don't have any time. I don't have any time, man. It's a lot. I do the lip service. I produce the reading series. So, you know, that's the other thing I'm doing. We got the Beast Crawls coming up. You know, Lit Quake. You know,
Lit Quake.
A lot of
oars. That's
not
really fair to say it's not. It's coming up.
But I have Beast Crawls. But I still do this all thing. You got to get the readers ready. You got to send the bios. It's just constantly little, you know, things you got to be doing. Being an adult is hard. It's really hard.
Yeah.
And I got kids, man. Well, my wife's on a camping trip. And, you know, kids, I mean, I'm not wired. I mean, I love those kids more than anything. But I'm a very high-strung person, you know. And these two little things, you know, running around, I get very worked up.
They can be very chaotic. I've got a small brood myself. I will say, my wife told me the other day, she goes, Tom, you may be a grown-up, but you're sure as fuck not an adult. And no, it was back there. She said, you may be an adult, but you're sure as fuck not a grown up. And that was in reference to my ability to manage my life, which is, it always seems I can't figure out why everybody else on the planet seems to have an easier time. Like, you know, people are out of work, but still manage to keep their homes or whatever they're doing. I'm like, how can you can swing that? And I can't even like just get out of bed in the morning without, having a throbbing headache, worried about what I have to do with my day. I don't understand why.
You work every day. You drive like 600 miles a day. You're never not working. I mean, you're always doing shit.
Well, it's smoke and mirrors, baby. That's from the outside. But you know, in here, I'm scrambling, pulling out my hair.
Nobody's put together. That's the AA thing, right? You fake it till you make it. You just keep faking it. Nobody. I don't know anybody. I mean, there's people I know, I guess, who have it together. I don't really hang out with them, though. You know, my sister's husband has it kind of together, I guess. But I mean, I don't.
They won't have you. Is that what you're saying?
Well, I just don't. You know, I mean, I don't know. Maybe I just thrive off of that kind of energy. You know, then you realize that, you know, maybe that's what makes you happy. That's what being in that condition is what you how you operate. That's just what you do. You know, like Ethan Frome's wife. Have you ever read Ethan Frome? Ethan Frome's wife, Zelda. Anyway, she's a mess of a human being until she's taking care of somebody else. And then when she's taking care of somebody else, she's great. She's at her absolute best when she's taking care of somebody else. If somebody else is sick or has a crisis, whatever, and she can turn to their needs, she's a fully functioning, wonderful human being. But when there's nothing wrong and all the focus is on her, she falls apart.
Well, yeah. So, but that doesn't apply to you. What you're saying is, unless
no, I just wanted to drop that. I read
you're, unless you're twisted
and
with a stomach ache full of anxiety,
so.
you're miserable. In other words, if you're miserable, you're okay.
I was talking to the real Jay Porter today, Jay Streeter, my brother, and he was like, "Yeah, you know, I just woke up the other day and I just threw up because I just got so stressed. I'm like, man, that is so going in a book. But yeah, I mean, I don't know. People have that all over, right?
Yeah,
it's
We've got an
my friend
we've got Peterson's an
always,
call
well,
I got to kidding because we're about to run out of time, and I haven't even
what do you
noticed.
Mean?
That
we
the
got 10 minutes.
Right. Huh?
We got 10 minutes, dude.
I'm the producer. The show's over when I say it's over. If I feel like it's running dry, man, I'm going to hit the kill button. I got one right in front of me.
All right.
It says,
what do you mean dry? This is good material. All right.
All right. Hang on a second.
It's Hector.
Welcome to Skid Row Chatter. You're on the air with Joe Clifford. Who's this?
Seriously, am I on right now?
You are on the air.
Well, hi, guys. This is Casey Woodbury from Southern California. You thought nobody was listening. I'm listening.
Yeah, well, wow, yes. I know Casey from the Avatar. I don't think – yeah, you got that little glass.
Yeah,
avocado
eyes.
Yes, well, good. Any questions?
Do you have a question or accusation level of Joe?
No accusations. Just wanted you guys to know people are listening.
Oh,
we're
well,
just
good.
Very
Thank
shy.
You. See? Yeah.
All right.
It's very
That's all I got, guys.
Plus, we don't stop talking enough for people to call. All right. Well, thanks.
All right, Casey from the NSA. Thank you very much for calling in. And
talk to you later.
We appreciate it.
We'll talk on the interwebs. Yeah. All right. Thank you. Good. See, told you people are listening.
All right. People are listening, which is kind of more unnerving than when you thought no one was listening, don't you think?
Not really, man. We've been doing this routine for fucking 15 years, right? This is just
what we've been
doing. Well,
I haven't felt under so much pressure to actually talk about books. You know, like when we were out on the street together, actually when the street we were in, that your brother's truck that you had out here on the West Coast for some reason. And we never talked about
– I stole it. Yeah.
we never talked about books. We never talked about literature. We never talked about authors. The one time I can remember is I had that Bukowski reading poetry cassette that got stuck in the cassette player in the truck, and it played every time you turned the truck on. Other than that, it didn't revolve around much literature.
I mean, I talk about books. We talk about books. I read Permanent Midnight. I read Permanent Midnight. That was a pretty big deal.
We didn't discuss it, baby. We lived it.
Well, we didn't have. I mean, we were busy doing other things. You know, you wake up, you're sick. You're shitting your pants. Your nose is running. You're not gonna be like, hey, you know, what do you think the governing motif of Moby Dick should have been? You're like, you just got other things going on. Right? I mean, more pressing concerns. We have to take checks to go to the bank.
It really was because I remember. Actually, I remember where this happened. We were driving like on right under the. On Division Street, under the freeway there, in the truck, and I remember you and you were telling me about having a real job and why you would never be able to have a real job again, and I had this job and I worked at a printer down in I think you said South San Francisco, and you were telling me about the pleasure and the smell of the ink and the feel of the paper and how connected you were to printing, and I thought, well, that's kind of weird.
I was probably high. I hated printing. I was probably high. I hated that job. Hey, Michelle Eisler wants to know, is it 347-633-9709?
I told you talked over the number. It's 347-633-9609.
Okay. 9609.
I'm using my dispatcher
hated that job, man. That job I probably did drugs because of that day job. Like that, I worked for 3 years, and I don't know. I mean, people who do that every day, God bless them. I don't know how you do it. It killed me, you know, because I go to work and I come home and I try to paint or play music or write or whatever. Oh man, that job killed me. So I hated that job.
I do remember that portion of the conversation is that you telling me that that's when you first started getting into smoking speed on tinfoil. I'm not quite sure why you would do that, but it
kept you up at night, and then I could go to work during the day, and then I could paint at night because I wouldn't have to sleep, which seemed good on paper. But after a few months, it turns out that you need to sleep, or stuff starts happening.
I remember being a wee lad, a bike messenger, and you know, like going to some place and like fixing dope and shooting speed simultaneously and then dropping my pants and wrapping my knees in ace bandages because my knees were so strained from running around that one speed, but just filling myself up full of all sorts of amphetamine just to keep on going. You know, it was not a healthy existence. All right, we got another caller here. I'm going to take a wild guess. I'm going to use my my psychic ability and maybe think that it might be a Texas prefix. Let's see.
Okay.
Hello.
It's me.
Welcome to Kid Row Shadow. You're on the air with Mr. Joe Clifford.
Hello, Tom. This is Michelle Eisler.
And
hi, Joe. Did you know it? Did you guess that? And I've been calling the wrong number all this time.
That's probably been going on a lot.
Listening.
I'm sorry?
Because Tom muttered the address, the number. That's why. He mumbled it. He didn't speak it
well,
clearly.
You know, I'm actually on there, and it says 9709. Maybe that's why you're not getting any phone calls.
Yeah.
Well, the guest call that I have, I'm going to repeat it one last time in case anybody else wants to sneak in at the end. It's 347-633-6909. Michelle, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. I am doing great.
6909 or 9609?
9609.
9609. 6909.
No.
Joe, It's all that tinfoil.
Not, it should be 9609, not, in, but it's written wrong on the computer. It doesn't matter. Let me get my question in. Okay, my question. I got how much? Okay, so first of all, I love Junkie Love. That's like my favorite. But from this book, one thing that I like, I've told you from the beginning, I really, really love how you describe Jay having like his anxiety attacks. I thought that it seemed so claustrophobic to me, and it seemed like a good characteristic for him. And if he's going to have this like throughout the rest of the books, like if you're going to have like a series, and this is always going to be like a problem for him.
I think it'll probably always be an issue. I don't know if it's going to be as bad as in December Boys. You know, I downplay it and I joke about it because that's just what you do. But I mean, I've had, you know, probably the worst panic attack I had was a 2 week stretch where I couldn't stop moving. I'd wake up. I could, strangely, it was the only time I could sleep, and I could sleep 8 hours, but I would wake up and I would have to start moving. I couldn't stay in one spot, and I would walk all day long. I couldn't stop walking. Chain smoking, walking. It was a strange. It was after I quit smoking, I took Chantix, which just exacerbated a problem. But you know, so I've had some really bad attacks, and you know, I have a doctor now, and I'm in treatment and all that stuff. But it's something that's governed my life for ever since I really, you know, once I hit my early teens, severe anxiety, and I treated it with drugs on my own, self medication, which a lot of people do, and now I'm treated with a regular old doctor, but. You know, when you have anxiety and it comes over you, you know, the thing that you can't do is just calm down. Well, just relax. What's so bad? It's nothing about what's wrong. It's nothing about what's bad. It's just this thing that happens, and it's a strange malady to have because it's not a cancer and it's not a, you know, a serious illness. It's this thing that's perceived to be just in your head. Like, well, so you're what? You're just nervous. But when it happens, it really feels like your whole world is falling apart. You can't do the things you can. And when you're well and you're not having it, you're like, how did that sideline me for 2 weeks? I can't imagine what happened to me where I was walking around like a lunatic for 2 weeks. But at the time, it was an awful, awful feeling. And I had nowhere to go until it ended. So, you know, I imagine Jay is gonna continue to deal with that because I continue to deal with it. It seems to be part of his character. Certainly, what's come about, you know, the results of his life, you know, what happened to my life, and part of, you know, my anxiety certainly is stemmed, you know, my mother dying, you know, just when I had gotten clean, and the trouble I've caused to the loved ones in my life, and the damage I've done, and they haven't come back, and you know, you live with that guilt, and that just piles on to the anxiety you feel. There's also the feeling that you know, at any minute, these riches that you've been given are going to be ripped away from you, which is another, you know, triggering event for me.
Because sometimes the people have anxiety attacks even when they're happy. So it doesn't even have to be like something traumatic happen. I mean, you can actually be like happy and then you still like, then you get anxious, like what you just said, that it may stop at any moment. And I just think it was interesting. Maybe I've missed out, but you know, most protagonists, they will have, you know, they'll be like alcoholics or they'll have some other demons, but I thought this was like really good. And it, like, I mean, you actually hit it on the head whenever you were describing the anxiety attacks. So I think it was good.
Good. Well, thanks. I mean, you write what you know, and I know addiction and anxiety attacks and being unhappy and being screwed up and getting divorced. So that's what happens to Jay, right? I mean, he, you know, he gets the.
So I assume that you're going to continue. Do you have more books coming up?
I have an idea. You know, I mean, Jay is anyone who's read the books can see he has a drinking problem. You know, and so that's something he's going to have to address. But I mean, really, what the heart, you know, the heart of all these books is. You know, a guy who knows he can do better and wants more and can't get out of his own way to get it. And so, you know, in addition to living in a really cold, hostile place. And the last book was, you know, ends. It was a hard ending for me to write because all these books are hard, you know, write in a sense, just because, you know, you're really getting into some deeper stuff and you're really fucking up people you really care about. So, there's plenty more ways to fuck up Jay and at the same time inserting a mystery for him to solve because that's, you know, these are all mystery novels and trying to find a mystery that doesn't feel like, you know, Murder, She Wrote is part of the fun. And it's also, you know, it's one of the challenges that you want there to be. You know, when you don't have a professional investigator, you have an amateur I think this is Father and Amateur Sleuth. You have to have a reason for him to investigate something, and that's always fun because you know that's part of the game.
Yeah,
it's
and
funny,
I think
one
it's
of my
interesting.
Favorite, one of my favorite things to do with Joe is you know he's so the character Jay is so tied to him. You know, mentally, and their history is so similar, and there's so much of them that is a common denominator. I won't say you're the same person because that's not fair, but there's a lot of common denominators there. So I like to call Joe up or text him at odd hours and say, "Man, that dude Jay is a jerk. I really don't." and I think I like to think that heightens his own anxiety, you know, just to keep the fire burning. And Michelle, you were right.
Getting me worked up is not hard.
Michelle was right. You know, the number was posted wrong on the on one of the, not both the Facebook sites, but not certainly the Blog Talk page. But it was wrong on the Joe Clifford coming out party. I thought you were going to announce your homosexuality for all of us to hear. But because I just looked at my phone and I got texts from Rokozon and some other folks that are like, "Hey man, we can't get through." So
I know.
C'est la vie.
So I'll let them call. I'll go ahead and let them call.
All right. Well, we'll
all right, good.
Michelle,
all right. Lovely talk to you, as always.
Your approval and thumbs up is always appreciated, and we'll always like when you call in and throw in your two cents. Thank you for calling.
All right. Bye, guys.
All right, bye.
Thank you.
Okay.
The Eislers are great.
Yeah.
I forgot to say, hey, say hi to Tommy, but I guess you can still hear me, so say hi to Tommy.
Yeah, say hi to Tommy.
Always
fun to see Tommy at the conferences.
It is. Right. And, you know, the first year I met him, he seemed like a bit of a wallflower, and he was like kind of just letting Michelle do her thing. And then the next year, you know, I got to know him a little better. And then by the third year, we were just elbow to elbow at the bar, throwing back bourbon, having a good time. I really liked Tommy.
One of the really sweet moments. I mean, after I lost the Anthony, which I didn't expect to win, but you still take it hard. Was I was sitting in the corner, just you know, kind of sulking a little bit because you sulk after you lose something like that. And he sat down and just talked to me about you know football and stuff. It was really sweet. Nice of him.
Hey, speaking of getting run over by the Anthony's, Mr. Panowich, he still never answered that text. I got to tell you, Joe, I'm a little bit hurt. I'm thinking about you know like starting a online harassment program to see what the heck's going on. I
talk to him every day, so I talk to him every day. So
you
I don't know if he doesn't. I talk to him all the time. He's on my fucking.
Well then,
feedback,
stop it. Well then, throw down the gauntlet and see what's going on, because now I'm starting to sweat it. Don't stop teasing me.
Well, I can't. Hey, I can't. Well, you can't call and tell me Jay Porter's a jerk, but I can't tell you that Brian Panowich doesn't want to return your call. I don't know why he wants to return all my calls. I call Panowich, he calls me back within 3 seconds, 3 to 5 seconds every time.
I had a feeling it was something to do with that.
Hold on,
Tom Creaky
I just got text. Brian Panowich just texted me. Hold on a second. Oh, man, that Panowich. Man, that guy is a fucking – right back at you, buddy. Yes, I don't know why he won't return your call. Try to leave a bad message.
I think I have the wrong number. At any rate, onward and upward, we're coming close to a wrap here. Roe apparently says
you've been
hi
trying to get me off this phone for the last hour. You know, like I think we were on for like 3 minutes. You're like, yeah, we're coming close. You know, we've been on like 6:15. You're like, yeah, we're coming towards the end. Done here.
Well, you know, people like
what do you want
a concise show. You know, it's like no one tunes in for 90
it's
minutes.
It's not a Ramones
of us.
Song, man. Yeah, people love us. What are you talking about?
It's not Days of Confused. Well, it might be Days of Confused, but it's not Stairway to Heaven either. Boy, that's some
I think this went very well. I think this Casey Wood, she thought it went well. Michelle Issa thought it went well. Hector, I mean, he's texting every 2 minutes, man. Brian Panowich,
I don't know if you noticed.
Texting me.
Hector's gone. That's not really Brian texting you. That's probably Ryan Sales just fishing.
Ryan Sales texted me the other day, too. Did he text you? Texted me.
Who's that?
Both our stories and Unloaded are second person. Ryan Sales texted me. Because we both wrote second person stories for Unloaded. Yeah.
I've been having an extensive back and forth with Ryan for the past month, and I really can't get into it because regardless of what Pan says about our ability to swear and bring up unsavory topics here and there, I think some of it's a little too racy for even our listeners.
Wow.
Speaking of Gutter Books, where we are both executives, what's next for what is the next anthology you're doing with Gutter?
Well, first, let me say Mike Creedon's book, All Your Lies Came True, is coming out in a couple of months. We pushed that back to coincide with the fall so that he can get better launches down at down in Florida. The anthology is the Cash Anthology, which is, it turns out that you don't need permission, and you might want to check this with your brother, but according to my sources, my sources being Lynn Barrett, you don't need permission if the person's dead. And last I checked, Johnny Cash is dead. So we should be able to do a Johnny Cash anthology. As soon as I finish these two books, I'm probably going to start doing that and reaching out to people. And I hope people aren't listening because I'll be inundated with, you know, tons of stories. But I'll reach out to people and put that together. I'm hoping to start that the second half of the year.
So the replacements anthology, which should be out before VoucherCon, by the way, which looks awesome. Jay Stringer has done a great job putting it together, and it's getting edited by Rob Pierce right now. Our buddy and also our nemesis, Rob Pierce, who's a great Eagle Eye editor. And I'm thinking now we should change the name to the Bob Stinson anthology so we don't get any heat from the replacements. What do you think?
I don't know.
I mean, who else is dead in that band? Nobody.
Yeah. I mean, well, no. Well, Slim Dudlop isn't.
No, it still counts.
So well.
He's got a bevy of attorneys ready to leap.
Yeah.
But anyway, that's news. That's news from Gutter. You stepped away from Flash Fiction Offensive, so you're still doing acquisition editing. But really, we're press light. We don't like to do a ton of books. There's only a couple of big small presses out there. It seems to me that are super active right now. Down and Out and All Due Respect are churning out stuff like crazy.
Just because fucking Mike Monson can read like a book in an hour. That dude just looks at a book. Remember, like, well, who's the guy that the mystic who could just claim he could put a book on his pillow at night and wake up and, you know, all the information was in his head. That's how Monson is, man. That guy reads so fucking fast.
Well, you know, when he was doing the commute to San Francisco from Modesto, he was really the king of reading because he had that extra time each day to just completely focus. And I kept on asking him, like, how do you do this? How do you do this? But he also he's explained some of his other tricks. I mean, he multitasks too, which I think speeds up his reading ability. But him, his addition to that company has
Edward
completely
Casey. Edward Casey.
Into
was the guy who said he could sleep on – Edward Casey claimed he could sleep on books and he'd wake up in the morning and he'd know everything in them.
Oh, yeah, anyway. Yeah. Well, he's all sorts of magic. I do know a little bit about that fraud. I mean, that fellow. Mike's in a different category. Mike's the real deal, and he doesn't make such outrageous claims. But his addition to ADR has really made that company blossom. And them and Down and Out and I don't know who else there is. Gutter is you know, the Gutter's got a trickle of literature going on. We like to pick the finest and the best and keep it not overwhelming. You know, Snub Nose is gone.
One Eyed Press.
One Eyed Press is I don't think they're going to continue publishing books. Double Life, as you know, is gone. Who else is there out there in the small press deal? So it's all going to be big publishers again soon. It was like a short blossoming time in the middle of this decade when it was an open season, open field, and now it's now the doors are slamming shut again.
Writing's stupid.
What's that?
Writing
is stupid. That's what I thought about naming the show instead of like Trial by Fire. Just writing is stupid. But I thought it might be a bit of a downer as far as bringing in new listeners.
Yeah, I mean that's the private joke between me and Tom because at least one of us, at least once a week, will text that to the other. it's a very frustrating field. I mean, it's great. I mean, it's not coal mining and it's not working in a fucking print shop. It's great, but it's disheartening. I mean, just because our relationship to time is not accurate. You know, we send off that submission and you check your email 6 seconds later and like the editor and all those people, they're like, they work on a different time schedule. They're years down the road. So
it's
weird.
It's not a game for anybody who's impatient, and there's no immediate gratification. Certainly, you know, you write a book, it takes a year for your agent to get through it, and then it takes a year for you got to re-edit it, and then it gets sent out. And like the book that I'm looking to get published now, which I don't know how much patience I have left with it, but it's I think I finished that in 2014. Yeah, 2014, 2015. Because I'm writing a book a year, I got three. I'm sitting on three at this point. So it's very like you say, the important thing is to forget about once you hit send on the email, forget about it and go back to what you're doing and stay in the moment and keep creating. I think that is a sound advice that you started the show with.
Well, thank you. That's I'm glad we went full circle. I feel like
you like that? See, that's a wrap. All right.
Yeah, that is some serious hosting. That was wow.
Once again, and my friend sometimes, nemesis at other times, the bane of my existence, and who conjures dark memories and drags me back to the terrible 90s every once in a while, my friend Joe Clifford, his new book, December Boys, a great sequel to the story Lamentation, will be out June 2nd, right? Technically, it's out now.
June 7th. That's technically.
I've been misinformed. Buy it, review it, love it. Not necessarily in those orders.
Order. I just need reviews. Once I get 100 reviews, once you get 100, that's kind of the magic number on Amazon. You get 100 reviews, you're eligible for the BookBub stuff and all that shit. So, reviews.
I think that
huge.
Magic number is relative to those of us who are nowhere near 100 reviews. So that's just,
there is no magic
back
number.
Up. You're going to enrage.
You get 100, then you want 200, and then I see, people got fucking 4,000. It's never enough. Poor man wanted to be rich.
By the same token. You see a book that is a classic or a great prize winner, a Nobel Prize winner, and they have seven or 10. So it's completely erratic.
Like Gone Girl or Girl on the Train, and you got like 1,000 bad reviews, and you just want to fucking find the people. How can you not
those
books?
We're too tied into Amazon. We have to be. That's the only place that the small press stuff is sold. So that's where I'm, locked into. But unlike when we were first publishing it with Snub Nose and stuff and checking the numbers and checking the reviews, I just had to let that go because I think it's too one-sided, Amazon. And you got to just put on blinders and plow ahead.
I'm just neurotic. I just check it because it's like, oh, my God, I got to check something. It's like a fucking nervous tick.
I
haven't checked.
Thank you very much.
Dr. Goldberg's retiring in a fucking year. My psychiatrist is retiring at the end of the year. I'm like, you can't retire. Like, I've got abandonment issues, man. You can't do that. You can't do that.
The worst part is he's probably lying. He's probably just saying that you'll drive by his office a month later and he'll still be open taking customers. All right. Dear friend, go back to the kids. Say hi to both of them for me. Your wife's out of town, right?
She's out of town. She's camping. She's camping.
Hey. Unreachable.
School.
So pay close attention to what you feed them, so no one breaks out in hives, so you don't have to call her.
Yeah, I haven't heard any noises in a while, so I should probably go check on them.
All right.
I give them each a pair of steak knives and have fun. I'm gonna go find out what happened to my kids.
We're bringing up the outro music. Farewell, right, solo. Join us next month for Max Allen Collins. If you don't know who that is, look him up. He's gonna be amazing, and it's gonna be a great show next month on June 25th, I believe. Au revoir from Skid Row Chatter.